think that's good. That's, yes, it's taken off the glare. And okay, so I'm ready to go. Thank you so much for inviting me tonight. This is probably going to be one of the most difficult Dharma talks that I've given, simply because it's like five in one. And I have to figure out how to string it all together. But, you know, when the Buddha taught, he taught according to the propensities of his people, of the people that were present. And many times there are people on a lot of, you know, when I say level, you know what I mean. I don't mean like hierarchical. But in different spaces, attending to different things in their life. And yet each one needs to be addressed. And so my Dharma talks sort of like weave it all together. That's why I can never take a chapter and teach on this. So I'm going to be kind of all over the place tonight. But if you follow with me, I think we will go somewhere. Each one of us, we will know how to take the next step. That's the important thing. Is all I need right now is what I need to take the next step. And this is how we progress in our gradual training. There was an occasion when the Buddha was staying with a group of his monks, and they got into an argument over something. And the Buddha tried to straighten it out, you know, and make peace, and they didn't want to hear that. And they were like, you know, we got this. We don't need your input, actually, is what they're saying. And very rude. And so he said, okay, fine. He got his bowl and his robe, and he walked off. And when he went off, he went to, he stopped and met with one of his disciples who was practicing alone. And he sat and he had lunch with him. And they talked a little bit. He said, are you keeping well? Are you comfortable? And are you having any trouble getting alms food? And he said, no, Venerable One. Can you hear me back there? Okay. So he said, no, Venerable One. And the Venerable taught him, instructed him, and he left. Then he went on to Eastern Bamboo Park. And there was Anuruddha, along with two other disciples. And the three of them were there seeking their own good, as it was called. And when he approached that park, there was a groundskeeper. And he said, I'm sorry, you can't go in. Don't disturb them. There are three venerables in here practicing, and it would not be a good time for you to come and visit them. But Anuruddha saw that it was the Buddha, and he ran and he got him, and he brought him over, and he said, I hope that everything is going good with you. And the Buddha said, yes. And he said, and what about with you? I hope that you're all living in accord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. And he said, surely, Venerable Sir, we are. We are living in accord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. And he said, but Anuruddha, how do you live like this? And he said, well, we think like this. It's gain for me. It is a great gain for me that I'm living with such companions. And I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness with this kind of appreciation in mind. I maintain good thoughts when I'm with them and when I'm not with them. It said, I think that if there's something that I would like done, perhaps they would like that done as well. And so I consider the others as myself. So he says, very good, very good. He said, but let me ask you another question. How do you abide diligent, ardent, and resolute? He said, as to that, whichever of us returns first from the village with alms round, that one sets out the food. He said, if somebody comes late and we finished eating, that one washes the dishes. He said, and in this way, we just take care of one another. When one sees something that needs to be done, he just takes care of that. And he says, and in this way, we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. And the Buddha said, good, good, Anuruddha. But while you are abiding thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, have you attained any superhuman states? A distinction in knowledge and vision, worthy of a noble one's, a comfortable abiding. He said, Venerable, as we abide here, diligent, ardent, and resolute, we perceive both light and the vision of forms. Soon afterwards, the light and the vision of forms disappear, but we have not discovered the reason for this. And so the Buddha said, you should discover the reason for that. Before my enlightenment, while I was just an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too perceived both light and a vision of forms. Soon afterwards, light and the vision of forms would disappear. And I thought, what is the cause of this? That the light and vision of forms should be here and then suddenly disappear. Then I discovered this. Doubt arose in me. And because of doubt, my concentration fell away. When my concentration fell away, the light and the vision of forms disappeared. Said, so I resolved, so I shall act that doubt will not arise in me again. As Anuruddha, I was abiding diligent, ardent, and resolute. I perceived both light and the vision of forms. Soon afterwards, the light and vision of forms disappeared, and I thought, now what is the cause? And what condition that the light and the vision of forms have disappeared? And then I considered thus, inattention arose in me. And because of inattention, my concentration fell away. And he said, so I will act so that neither doubt nor inattention will arise in me. And he said, and Anuruddha, I was abiding diligent, and I discovered this, sloth and topa arose in me. And because of sloth and topa, my concentration fell away. And I resolved that I will act so that neither doubt nor inattention nor sloth and topa will arise in me again. And the reason why I want to do this Dhamma talk is before we go into meditation, because I think it's going to help carry us somewhere beyond where we have been before. So he says, Anuruddha, I was abiding diligent and all that, and I considered thus, fear arose in me. And because of fear, my concentration fell away. And the light and the vision of forms disappeared. Suppose a man set out on a journey and murderers leaped out on both sides of him. Then fear would arise in him because of that. So too, a fear arose in me. And I said, I shall act so that neither doubt nor inattention nor sloth or torpor nor fear will arise in me again. So now, Anuruddha, I was abiding diligent and ardent and resolute, and I considered thus, an elation arose in me. And because of elation, my concentration fell away. And when it fell away, the light and the vision of forms disappeared. And Anuruddha, I was abiding diligent, ardent, and aware, and I considered thus, inertia arose in me. And you know the story. And I was abiding diligent and ardent, and excess energy arose in me, and my concentration fell away. And I was abiding diligent and ardent, and deficiency of energy arose in me, and concentration fell away. And I was abiding diligent and ardent, and I considered thus, longing arose in me, yearning arose. And then I was abiding diligent and ardent and aware, and perception of diversity arose in me. And then excessive meditation upon forms arose in me. And then when I understood all of these things are imperfections of the mind, I abandoned. I abandoned doubt. I abandoned inattention. I abandoned sloth and torpor. I abandoned fear. I abandoned elation. I abandoned inertia. I abandoned excess of energy. I abandoned deficiency of energy. I abandoned longing and desire. I abandoned perception of diversity. I abandoned excessive meditation upon forms. All of them, imperfections of the mind, imperfections of the mind. And so as we move into our talk tonight, I want us to just hold that for a minute. And now we're going to go into something about our actual meditation practice. Vachagata. There is no householder who, without abandoning the fetters of householdership on the dissolution of the body, has made an end of suffering. Now that's a sad commentary. Vachagata, there is no householder who, without abandoning the fetter of householdership on the dissolution of the body, has made an end of suffering. So it's not householdership, is it? It is the fetters. So what are these fetters of householdership that cause us to not reach our goal? And this is what I want to talk about tonight. There are seven kinds of persons. And we can know which kind of person we are. There's no mystery to this. There are four kinds of, four levels of liberation. And we can know exactly where we are. There's no mystery about it. Just if we don't know, we don't know. But if we do know, then we can abide resolute and abandon the imperfections of mind. He said the first kind of person is one who's called a faith follower. Now, faith follower says this person does not contact with the body and abide in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial. That means they're very literal, very here and now, you know. Only what I can see, touch, taste, handle, smell. Okay. So they don't abide in those places that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending form. Says, yet they have heard something of the sublime teaching, and they have believed it and taken hold to it, hoping that this will show its way out in their life. And so little by little, they have some success, and they develop a faith, even around things that they have not personally experienced. It says, and I say to them, they have work to do with diligence. Says, but then there's a person who's called the Dhamma follower. Dhamma follower also does not contact with the body and does not abide in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending form. And his taints are not yet destroyed by his seeing with wisdom, but those teachings proclaimed by the Tathagata are accepted by him. And after reflecting on them sufficiently with wisdom, he begins to attain the qualities of mindfulness, of concentration, of wisdom. And this kind of person is called a Dhamma follower. The third kind of person is called one liberated by faith. And here this person does not contact with the body, nor make abide in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms, but there is some of the taints destroyed, the imperfections, by his seeing with wisdom, and a faith is planted and it's rooted and established. And these kinds of persons are called ones liberated by faith. They have entered the stream and enlightenment, liberation is their goal. They are bound for it. There is no turning back. It says, but then there's a person who is attained to view. And here this person does not contact with the body or abide in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms, but some of his taints are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. And he has reviewed and examined with wisdom the teachings proclaimed, and this kind of person is called one attained to view. And of course, I say he still has work to do with diligence. Then there is the kind of person who's called the body witness. Here, this person does contact with the body and abides in the liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending form, and some of his taints are destroyed by wisdom. This person is called a body witness, and he still has work to do. And there's the kind of person who is one liberated by wisdom. This person does not contact with the body and abide in liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms, but his taints are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. And that kind of person is called one liberated by wisdom. His method of practice is dry insight. And then there's the kind of person called one liberated in both ways. Here, some person contacts with the body and abides in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending form, and his taints are destroyed also by seeing with wisdom. And this is the one that attains through both insight and jhana, abiding here and now in the Brahma Viharas. And so it says there are these seven kinds of persons to be found existing in the world. And so as I went through this today, I could know what person I was. So there was no doubt. You know, sometimes we're confused about where we are on the path. And because of our confusion, doubt arises in our heart or in our mind. And we get befuddled, or we go off on a tangent, or we lose our stability. And that's what I like so much about this teaching. At any point, I can look and see and know exactly where I am by going inside and putting it up against the line-by-line, step-by-step methodology that he left. And so he starts at a particular person. He says there are six temperaments: the greedy temperament, hateful temperament, intelligent temperament, faithful temperament, speculative temperament, and delusional temperament. So first we should know of what temperament we are. And he goes into a whole description of what these temperaments are and how you can tell. I can tell, as it doesn't take a supernatural power to tell. He goes into a whole description about the kinds of mental states that are occurring. And one of a greedy temperament, there's a frequent occurrence of such states as deceit, fraud, pride, evilness of wishes, greatness of wishes, discontent, foppery, and personal vanity. In one of a hating temperament, there are states such as anger, enmity, disparaging, domineering, envy. In one of a deluded temperament, there are mental states occurring, such as stiffness, torpor, agitation, worry, uncertainty, and holding on tenaciously with refusal to relinquish anything. In one of a faithful temperament, there are such states as free generosity, desire to see noble ones, desire to hear good dharma, great gladness, ingenuousness, honesty, and trust in things that inspire trust. In one of an intelligent temperament, there's the frequent occurrence of such states as readiness to be spoken to, possession of good friends, knowledge of the right amounts of in eating and mindfulness, in awareness, devotion to wakefulness, a sense of urgency about things that one should be urgent about, and wisely directed endeavor. In one of a speculative temperament, there's the frequent occurrence of such states as talkativeness, sociability, boredom with devotion to profitable things, failure to finish undertakings, smoking by night and flaming by day. That is to say, hashing plans at night and putting them into effect by day. And mental hither and thither. And this is how temperaments may be recognized. And then he goes on into a whole lot of detail about this. He talks about the suitable resting place for one of each temperament. He talks about the kind of environment that should be set up depending on the temperament. He talks about the people who should serve him or help him when he's in his meditation space. He talks about how the meditation room should be laid out according to temperament. Then he talks about what views should be readily seen, even from the window, according to temperament. And then he talks about the meditation subject or the meditation object. And he identifies and goes into great detail about 40 different meditation subjects or meditation objects that the giver of the meditation subject should consider according to temperament. And so you see, it was a lot different than it is now. We didn't like just all come together and we do this one thing. And that's why there was great development and there was swift attainment, because it was according to certain causes and conditions. There were factors. And so a student went to the teacher and asked for a meditation object. And the teacher, if they had the ability, mind-wrapping mind, they assigned one according to the temperament. And he said, and if the teacher didn't have that particular gift, that particular talent, that particular development of supernormal power, then he just asked him certain questions. And as he asked them questions, the Buddha had already given the answers of what to look for. And that's how the teachers trained in those days. And then he gave him a meditation subject and he said, and go practice this for 3 days in this kind of environment. Set up your meditation room or your area this way. And in 3 days, if you don't have some attainment, you come back and you get another meditation subject. Yeah, that's how it was done. And so, the Buddha, when he attained in the third watch of the night, said he entered into the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, went all the way through all the jhanas, and then insights arose. And these two insights took him beyond to the other shore. This vipassana, these insights into not self, impermanence, and suffering, dukkha. Dukkha because everything is impermanent. And a clear seeing that nothing is me or mine. But look at how he did it. He went through the jhanas until he attained nibbana here and now, pleasant abiding. And he went through the four Brahma viharas, the jhanas being the mental states, the Brahma viharas being the heavenly abodes. Right here. Right now. And that's the promise that is available to us if we walk on a certain path. And so sometimes we're working with our mind, trying to understand certain concepts. We're like pressing in, trying to really get it, trying to see it. We're fiddling with our words and we have our whole jargon set up, you know, and after a while we just start Paul Parrot in the jargon. But I say if it's taking 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, then we figure out, well, we missed something. And that's why I became a monk. Because I said, you know, my books are too superficial. My teaching is too superficial. I want the whole deal. I want the whole ball of wax. And if the only way I can get it is this way, I go this way. Because I want to get it. But when I got it, the Buddha said he taught with an open hand. So everything, all of the teachings should be available. And that's why everything that I learn as a monastic, I share with non-monastics. Because nothing should be kept in a closed fist. So, there's Sariputta, and he's dealing with a householder, and he's sick. And he's dying. He says, how are you doing? Are you getting well? He said, no, Sariputta. I am not getting well, and I'm not comfortable. He said, are your painful feelings decreasing? He said, no, Sariputta. My painful feelings are not increasing. Decreasing. As a matter of fact, they're increasing. Their subsiding is not apparent. He says, I'm not getting well. I'm not comfortable. My painful feelings are increasing. And I'm dying. And so Sariputta said, then householder, you shall train thus. I will not cling to the eye. And my consciousness will not be dependent on the eye, on what I see. I will not cling to the ear. And my consciousness shall not be dependent on what I hear. I shall not cling to the nose, and my consciousness shall not be dependent on what I smell. I shall not cling to the tongue, and my consciousness shall not be dependent on what I taste. I will not cling to the body, and my consciousness shall not be dependent on what I feel. I will not cling to the mind, and my consciousness will not be dependent on what I think. He said, this householder is how you should train. And he began to train, and he said, I'm not gonna make it, Ananda. I am sinking. But I have waited long upon the teacher, and never before have I heard such a talk on the Dhamma like this. And he said, that's because such talks on the Dhamma householders are not given to lay people. Such talk on the Dhamma is given only to those that have gone forth. He said, well then, Venerable Sariputta, let such talks be given to lay people, because they are clansmen with little dust in their eyes who are wasting away through not having such talks as this. Now, how do we get into this space where we're not clinging to, our understanding is not dependent upon what we see and what we hear and what we taste, what we touch, or what we smell, or what we think? He said there is a space of no thingness, much like a vessel of water, that if we dip ourselves into it, then our understanding is transformed. Our understanding is changed. And we move from being in a limited space into a vastness. And this is where our meditation practice takes us, this continual dipping, this going in and coming out. And little by little, he said, it is a gradual way. It's a gradual training, but it's by direct experience. Not just somebody talking some blah, blah, but it's when you touch it yourself, you experience it yourself, then you come away knowing something deep within. He said, there's the outer that informs us and can be misleading for us. But there is this inner wellspring that is true and that is all revealing. And he said, and as we go into it, there are certain factors that are necessary for this to be opened up to us. He said, first it takes applied and sustained focus on something. And he gave us the training in focusing on the breath. Why? Because it's always with you. There are other objects that you could use, but this one's always with you. If it's not with you, yeah. So here it is. Applied means you have to put your attention there. Sustained means you stick to it. Remember when I first started reading, and he said, certain things became apparent to me, but then they fell away. And why did they fall away? Because the concentration fell away. The attention dropped off. Fear arose. Doubt crept in. All of these things. So we learn how to fasten to something, like training the puppy to the paper. Just taking and putting him back. And the puppy runs off, taking and putting him back on the paper. Puppy runs off, taking and putting him back on the paper. And after a while, the mind starts to understand, oh, I'm supposed to stay right here right now. And this is it. This is this training that we undergo. You know, so we're not sitting here letting go for a while, taking a snooze, going into la-la land, but we're training the mind for a particular purpose. And he said that we have to arouse a certain amount of energy, otherwise sloth and torpor will set in and we'll start nodding off. He said, but you can't arouse too much energy or you'll get hyper. And then your mind will start just going all over the place. So it's finding that right balance between being relaxed and being energetic. Not too relaxed. Kind of like on this tightrope, can't lean too far to the left or too far to the right. But sometimes you move back and forth to just kind of keep yourself steady. This is how we practice. This is what we do. So there is taking the attention to something, applied, holding it there, sustained. Then he says, with joy. With joy. So if we're going through our long things, sitting here and we're sitting here, and we're sitting here and we're sitting here, and there's no joy emerging, just know you're not going to get anywhere. So it takes a certain joy. He said, so how does this joy come about? He said, the joy comes about when you find that you can, like, stick with your object of meditation. You ever had a puppy that you trained to the paper? The day that puppy learns how to stay right there and tinkle, it's a glorious day for you and for the puppy. You know, the puppy, he's so happy, he's so proud of himself. You know, that's a good doggy, that's a good, you know, and he gets all of this praise, and he knows he did a good thing, you know. So there is a joy that comes with the success of accomplishment, when finding that effortlessly I can stick with my object, that I can reel in this mind. It doesn't just lead me through the nose and take me anywhere it wants to go, you know? And so I get a certain degree of confidence, a certain degree of calm, a certain degree of a sense of skillfulness. I have and there is a joy that begins to arise because of this. Anyone who's lost their temper, you know, and you said, no, I really didn't want to do that. I really regret I did that. I didn't mean to do that, but something just took a hold of me, and I just lost it. I just can't handle myself. We know how that feels. We know that when fear arises and it stalks us, and we don't want to be afraid, and yet we can't put it apart. We can't put it away. We can't lay it down. It's, where is it? It's in here. In the mind, and I cannot control the mind to avoid the worry. Sometimes I say, no need to worry. I know, but I just can't help it. So we know how this feels. We know that the dissatisfaction that comes in our life doesn't have as much to do with what's happening out there as it does how we're handling it in here. How our minds speak. This we already know. And so to be able to get that little bit of skill in just keeping the mind exactly where I place it, said, a joy begins to arise. This joy is like a being on a desert and seeing an oasis. You know, you don't have to hope over the next hill, the sand dune, there's an oasis. You see it. It's there. You haven't reached it, but you see it. So that means waters are coming. It's in my view. So this mastery, self-mastery, mastery of mind, it's in my view. And a joy arises. And you just stick there with it. He says, now the thing about sticking with it is that there is a unification of mind that occurs. You lose the sense of a me and a that. This duality drops away. It falls away. And there is just this union. There's a luminosity, that there is no separateness. And with that, it's like having reached that oasis and taken a drink. So now the roughness, the little edginess of the, there's water, goes away. And there's like this deep, deep bliss, this satisfaction after I've taken a drink. All of this just from applied and sustained focus. And so after a while, then that bliss even starts to get too coarse. And the bliss falls away. It's just like everybody loves to smile. You know, but I mean, like, how long can you smile? After a while, even the smile, you know. And then you just drop back into a natural relaxation. It's like that. So equanimity is kind of like that. There's the maintenance of that gladness, but really not even any need to smile. There's a deep stillness, a completion. And this is the progression, he says, and following this, we enter into the first jhana, or the first meditative attainment, into the first heavenly abode right here, right now. And then he goes and he talks, and it takes you even further and until different things drop away and different things drop away and different things drop away. But that's the beginning point. He says when you do that, you'll find you can sit for hours. Hours feel like minutes. You don't have to sit for hours. You can sit for minutes, and that's sufficient. You know, everything then becomes flexible. Everything becomes only what's necessary. We know what's necessary. We know what to say. When you come into a room, you don't have to think about it, what you're going to do. You know, you get there, and you know how to let it unfold. Doesn't mean that we don't prepare, but it means we know how to... We do the right amount of feeding, you know. We know the right way to come at somebody. We know how to execute. And then, because not everything is dependent on us, not everything is dependent on what we do. We do not control everything. We can get to a place that it doesn't matter how things come together. We can still remain in this state of ease. Why? Because we've practiced. We're skillful in it. We know where it is. We can just go right there. So something happens, and it's a sad thing, or it's a hurtful thing, or it's a, it's just a wicked thing. It's injustice. Speaking of compassion, you know, the thing about compassion is you have to be in these states in order for it to really be compassion. Because compassion has with it a certain equanimity. That's why people start working with things and they get burned out. Because the compassion, the lid on the compassion jar not screwed on quite right, you know? And so we have to go back and do some work with it. We have to figure out, you know, what's a little bit askew. And so this is it. There has to be, and you know, we've translated the word aloof, but our aloofness is really more like indifference, and that's it. That's missing. It's just completely out of the ballpark. But this kind of aloofness that the Buddha was talking about was this kind of equanimity that allows you to hover above whatever the situation is, because you've managed to recognize that it's not you, that it's not yours, that it's not personal, nothing in this life. And unless I die, there's always tomorrow. And that's the approach that we take to life. And we become fearless. And we become empowered. And we become clear. And we become articulate. And we become joyful. So they were called the happy ones. Well, they were also called the analyzers, you know. You know, because and you know that's true, because the Buddha has the 5 this, the 10 that, the 14 that, the all those numbers. But they were called the happy ones. And this was a happiness, a joy, that the world, what they connected with out here through the sense gates didn't give them. And so the world can't take it away. So I say to you, we go in to find this space. And this is the fruit, the real fruit of our practice. And we come out into the world and we can serve with joy and with clarity and with a success that's not dependent on everything working out right, but with the success in the sense of knowing you did the thing that should be done. And then we don't have to be attached to the outcome. That's how you cannot be attached to the outcome. It doesn't matter then whether you win or lose. You know, I always say it doesn't matter whether you win or lose, but how you play the game. Okay, it does. Winning counts. But this is a different type of winning. See, it's a different type of winning. It's one that is born of an inner integrity and a wisdom that knows that the right action was taken at the right time by the right person in the right way to the right person. And this is the kind of assurance that you can walk through in life, but it must be developed. So in case anybody was wondering why we sit, this is why we sit, and this is the fruit of our sitting. Now remember, I want to end it right there, because I talked about a whole lot tonight, and I usually don't give this serious a talk. If you know me, you know I don't. But I'm excited to be able to share this kind of a Dhamma talk, because this is not one that is easy to be received. This is one for people with little dust in their eyes. And we try to understand this whole notion of not self, but instead it's not a thing you're gonna get intellectually. That would be like trying to explain blue to a blind man. Can I do it? But it is something that we can apprehend experientially. And then we know who and what we really are. Beyond the superficial label that we have, beyond this conception of I am a person, I am Panyawati, these are my children, and this is my house, and beyond all of those superficial things, beyond the level of the elements, that I am earth and fire and water and air, and there is cohesion, expansion, and heat. Beyond all of that, and that's pretty deep, but beyond all of that, all the way to the place of what came, asking what came before that, moving in to the sphere of nothingness out of which something has emerged that deep, then that's something to know. And this is where our practice leads us. Could you imagine what could be accomplished in this world if we practice and attain? We don't have to wish for a good president. We don't have to wish for, you know, good legislators. We don't have to wish for, you know, we can be all that and more. We can create a Brahma world right here, right now. Brahma world is where Brahmas are. And if we attain, he said, here and now we can enter into Nibbana. So, after Sariputta gave this teaching to this householder, he died. And this is what happened. Then, when the night was well advanced, one illuminating the whole of Jetta's Grove, appeared and paid homage to the Buddha. And he gave a stanza, you know, and it's 16 lines, so I'm not going to read it. And he said, and the teacher approved. And when the night had ended, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, last night, when the night was well advanced, there came to me a certain young god of beautiful appearance who illuminated the whole of Jetta's Grove. And he said, and it tells everything he said. And that is what that young god said. And then he vanished at once. And when this was said, the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, surely that young god must have been Anathapindika, for that householder had perfect confidence in Sariputta. Good, good, Ananda. As far as reasoning goes, you have drawn the right conclusion. That young god was formerly Anathapindika and no one else. This is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Ananda was satisfied and he was delighted in the Buddha's words. So, when we come back from our break at 7:57, we'll take about 10 minutes. Is that a good enough time? And then we're going to go into a meditation. Now, you know, when we are practicing Vipassana, and we're like just watching momentary arisings, but if stuff arises the whole time you're sitting there, then we haven't gotten very far. It's just one thought after another, one thought after another. It's really like monkey mind. It's just staying there. We're just silent about it, you know. But at some point, thoughts just drop off. And we should be able to abide like one who's approaching the oasis. And then at some point, we take that drink. The Buddha said, I see the light and the visions behind the eyelids. But when my concentration falls away, it's all gone. I want you to hold your hand out in front of you. And right there, like in the palm of your hand, just look right there for a second. And then just drop that hand and close your eyes and look right at that spot, right there at the where the palm of the hand was, right there. Can you find it? Right there, that's where it is. You got it? Okay, open your eyes. Now, it's right there. That's where it is for me. It's right there. Right there. Right there. Can you just take your eye right there to that space? Okay, so when we sit in meditation tonight, and as we go into our breathing, and I'm going to do some guided, and then it's just going to drop off. But I want your eyes to just close your eyelids very loosely, very softly. And as if your eyes were open, just right there. Just look right there. Just a gentle gaze, not a piercing gaze like you're trying to see something, but just letting the eyes rest normally, let them fall right there in front of you. That's all you do. And that just parks the eyes somewhere and just lets you forget about them. So I just want you to remember that instruction because we're going to be focused on the breath. But just let the eyes fall right there, okay? Okay, let's take a quick break.